Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development will now be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. And before we start our regular agenda, Commissioner Pogemiller is going to come to the table and just take 2 minutes to review with the members the governor's supplemental budget proposal. Commissioner Pogemiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The governor just did a press conference a half hour ago. And so you'll recall the original budget was $92.9 million. The additional now is $195.44 million. In addition, so the total package recommended for post-secondary is $288.34 million. And where he gets that, I'll just go through quickly. Originally, he had $62.6 million for the university. He's added an additional $32.6 million, and that then assures the tuition freeze in his mind. So it's the 65.
And the report language is a little.
$65.2 million on the tuition side, and then $30 million that he had in his original budget for the preeminent medical research. Minsky, you recall, was zero in the original budget. He's now suggesting $142 million, and that absolutely covers a tuition freeze, if not more. State grant was originally $25 million. He's added an additional $20 million for a total of $45 million. In addition, he has added $800,000 to ensure that there is not a waiting list on the American Indian scholarships. We've done some recalculation. Last year, last budget, you eliminated the waiting list. This assures that there will not be an additional waiting list. What has happened is, now that American Indian students have figured out that they can go because of the scholarship, the list has grown again. So this is a good thing that the list grew again. And that $800,000 will ensure that for this biennium, there's no waiting list. Any student who is eligible will receive a grant. In addition, Madam Chair, he has added the $40,000 necessary to pay for the increased MEC fees, Midwest Higher Educational Consortium. So he has added that. I believe that's everything then, Madam Chair. So, originally it was $92.9 million. Now it's an additional $195.44 for a total of $288.34 million.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So with that, we'll begin with Senate File 951. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Very pleased to be with you today, and thank you for time on your busy agenda. Again, I have Senate File 951, and this bill in particular deals with the higher National Guard members' resident status for higher education grants and scholarship purposes. So I've also have an author's amendment, Madam Chair, if I could offer that.
Please.
And it is the well, it's 15-2635. I believe that's the one in the packet, unless there's – it's the one I brought with me.
Yeah, we've got an A-15.
Okay, A-15. Doesn't make sense. Yeah, this is the one. A-15 is the one. That's correct.
So, members – you should have that in your packet. Okay. Senator Miller moves the A-15. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And now the bill arranges the items. The active member of the state's National Guard who is domiciled in Minnesota and then and also resides in Minnesota, or an active member of the reserve component of the United States Armed Forces whose duty station is located in Minnesota and who resides in Minnesota. So it just makes it just a little more clear and specific, and I appreciate being able to have that information. And, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier with me today, Colonel Kerr, who is currently serving as a civilian as the Executive Director of Minnesota Department of Military Affairs, who will testify on this bill.
Thank you very much. Colonel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And again, for the record, my name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. And we appreciate very much you looking at this bill today. What the bill does is add one category of eligibility to remove the one-year residency requirement in cases for military members who are residents of Minnesota. And the amendment actually adds any component in Minnesota, which we think is fine. It simply opens up eligibility for service members who may be moving to Minnesota following training and could not meet the one-year residency requirement, or are moving to Minnesota for some other reason and because of their military service were not able to meet the residency requirement. This basically waives that one-year waiting period and allows them to be eligible for grants, higher education grants from the Department of Higher Education.
Very good. Any questions, members? Well, Senator Kiffmeyer, thank you very much for proposing it. We all want to do everything we can to make sure that we provide educational opportunities to those who serve. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just in closing, I appreciate your consideration of this in your policy bill. This is especially important to be able to recognize that we have a very large contingency in Minnesota since 9/11, larger than usual. And so they usually in your National Guard, you don't have this overseas duty and then coming back. They've been more of a in-state service. So this is really, really important for them now. And these are the ones who have really put their lives on the line for us and have given extra in regards to their service. So appreciate it very much if we can consider this for your policy bill. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
And members, I think we are going to actually move the bill to finance so that we can request a fiscal note. So,
okay. Madam Chair, we did check with the House, and there was a fiscal note on the same language in the House, and it did not have a fiscal note, but if you would like me to go to finance or if we can double-track it that and keep it here and then move to finance, if you would just want to consider that.
Well, Senator Kiffmeyer, we are policy and finance here, so we really do keep it here either way. So
okay.
So we'll go ahead and move Senate File 951 as amended. If somebody, Senator Claussen, moves Senate File 951 as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to finance.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Madam
All
Chair.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I have Senate File 1300 before you today. And I will be requesting an author's amendment. Many of you have heard through social and traditional media there's a heightened national conversation about sexual assaults on our campuses, and this bill gives us the opportunity to bring the conversation about sexual assault on campus here to a public policy setting so that we can help our parents and students to better understand that Minnesota college campuses are safe, but give them information about the colleges they might be looking at here in Minnesota. It's an opportunity to change the conversation on our campuses that would lead to a change in culture, where sexual assaults become less frequent, where victims aren't afraid to come forward, where we are very respectful of how difficult that situation might be. And it also gives us an opportunity to coordinate with our local law enforcement so our campuses become part of a community more aware of sexual assaults and how they would be prevented. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to explain my amendment if someone would move it for me.
Sure. Senator Miller moves the A-15 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Benson.
And thank you, Madam Chair. There's been significant work done in the House. The language that was originally presented was a vision, but we understand there's a lot of work that has been done at the federal level, including the Clery Act, Title IX, the Campus Save Act. There's been a Dear Colleague letter providing guidance to our college campuses, and there's other federal legislation giving us definitions and language moving forward. And so the amendment was redrafted to include a lot of that, to limit the new data that our colleges would have to be collecting and simplify the process for them. Many of our college, the differences between some of the federal legislation and our legislation, the Clery Act is all crimes. We would be looking at just sexual assaults. The Clery Act also includes the larger community around the campus. We would be limiting it to campuses and activities, programs, organizations, or events sponsored by the institution. So we'd be limiting the geography and limiting it to just sexual assaults. Title IX at the federal level has to be acted on by the campus but not be reported. So we'd be asking them to report some of their Title IX findings. That's kind of the big differences in data. Let me talk to you about what our campuses are already doing. In addition to all their federal data collection, they are already working on, MNSCU has a video system that they can customize for their campuses that they introduce as part of orientation when someone comes to the campus. And they've done significant work in training their staff and reaching out to their communities already. They have worked very hard to be part of this bill process, and so I commend our private institutions, the University of Minnesota and MNSCU, for coming forward. As we go forward, I would like to draw members to what our focus is going to be as we move through the bill. Victims' rights, amnesty for those people who would assist in reporting a sexual assault, law enforcement coordination, and summary data that would be brought forward to the Office of Higher Education, along with the comprehensive training for staff and students. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have testifiers, if it's a good time for the committee to hear from them.
Sure. So we can hear from testifiers. If members have questions or comments, feel free to ask those questions as this process goes on. So go ahead.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Joelle Stangler, I believe, could come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joelle Stangler, and I represent students at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities as the undergraduate student body president, and also represent the Minnesota Legislative Coalition, which represents the legislative interests of the entire system. Thank you for taking up the issue of sexual assault today and for the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill. We've done a lot of work with Representative O'Neill in the House and feel very strongly that this is a good bill, a good compromise across the board, and that we urge you to support it. 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted during their 4 years in college, and with nearly 450,000 students enrolled in post-secondary education, that's 40,000 students at risk on their college campuses. We support this bill today because it provides practical solutions to addressing the issue of sexual assault on college campuses that complements the work that institutions are already doing. There are 3 parts of the bill I'd like to address today. The first is the expansion of victims' rights. We feel this is a clear message that needs to be sent to victims. As you've seen in national and local media, victims often feel silenced, and so by expanding the rights and making it clear in statute what those rights are, it really is sending a clear message to victims that we believe them and we support them in their journey after these tragic events. The second component of the bill that we're very supportive of is coordination with local law enforcement. We understand that a lot of efforts are currently being made, but by creating a standard for what that coordination is, will really allow police departments to limit the confusion that victims face when they're coming forward, especially when you're looking at institutions such as the university, where there is an on-campus jurisdiction that has to work in tandem with the local jurisdiction, University of Minnesota Police Department, with the Minneapolis Police Department. This is a crucial component, is to make sure that there is a constant line of communication. We've had a number of victims come to us and express that there needs to be that increased communication, because there's often disconnects between those different levels of jurisdiction. And the third thing we're very supportive of today is the data collection. We understand that this is an issue that we are only beginning to scratch the surface of understanding with, and that we need to really focus on what is the prevalence of this issue, what are the punishments being handed down, what do we and don't we know about sexual assault on college campuses before we can make further public policy decisions. And so we're very supportive of the data collection and the transparency it provides to Minnesota students and families and in the bill as a whole. So I'll yield for questions if there are any, but I just want to thank Senator Benson for bringing this forward to the committee today.
Thank you, Ms. Stangler. Any questions for Ms. Stangler? Senator Torres-Wright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first one is related to page 3, line 312. I'm just puzzled about the whole issue of allowing a sexual assault victim to practice their religion and exercise their civil rights. I'm curious about what that means and why do we have to put it in law? Isn't it a given if they have a religious affiliation? That is, what does that have to do with this process? I would like to have a kind of a clearer understanding of what that means. And my second question is in page 2. Four, five, six, 4 says requiring campus authorities to treat sexual assault victims with dignity. Isn't that a given? I mean, we have to require that they are treated with dignity. I just wonder is it that we have cases in which people have documented that people are not treated with dignity? I just have a kind of a difficult time putting in law things that should be a given, requiring campus authorities to offer sexual assault victims fair and respectful health care, counseling services. So I kind of have some difficulty with this language, and I would like just to hear a little bit about why do we have to state that in law, that people have to be treated with dignity, that people have to be treated with respect, that they have the right to practice their religion.
And Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres, right, not to deflect the question, but we do have a testifier from Mincasa who might be able to come up and be very specific about why that language is included. If we could ask Ms. Palmer to come up now, Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I'm just looking at this. I'll be interested in this testimony, too, but the way I was reading that, Senator Torres Reyes, that it's the preparation of a victim's rights document that is available to a victim so that they are informed about their rights. It's not. I didn't read this to be so much about policies for the universities as it was that there be a policy required at a minimum require students' employees to be informed of the policy and shall include provisions for. So it's about informing victims of their rights, which they may not know. So that's how I was reading subdivision 2, section 2, subdivision 2.
Well, and Senator Torres, should we hear from Ms. Palmer?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Law and Policy Manager from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And yes, with regard to what Senator Sharon just said, I was going to echo that. This really is a recitation of rights. And it's things that we would like to see colleges talking about as far as a list of victim rights. And I do agree, sometimes, you want to make sure people already know these things. But sometimes it's really important to reinforce these issues, too, as we help to have sexual assault victims get respectful care and treatment.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do agree with that. Obviously, I don't disagree.
Yeah.
To me, it's just kind of interesting, though, that we have to kind of do that in here. I just have a hard time thinking, is it that it's not enforced or that the rules and the protocols that they have adopted not specific enough or are not clear enough that we have to have a law in place that basically says that. I just wanted to hear a little bit of perspective as to why do we have to have this in policy, such a directive on something that should happen anyway.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I believe part of the reason why it's here is, this is not just to people who are protecting victim rights on campus. It's a message to the whole campus. These are the principles that we want to uphold as we are moving forward to address the issue of sexual assault. So this is something that everybody will read and know that we think is an important value on the campus.
And, you know, I think as time goes on and people become more and more familiar with this issue, maybe we don't have to get into those specifics. But I think right now it's important that we do talk about reminding people about these specific rights and responsibilities.
Thank you.
Senator Torres-Wright, we'll ask Mr. Fuller to provide a legal opinion.
Well, Madam Chair, I think Senator Torres-Wright raises a point of statutory interpretation, which is, you know, one of the rules, if you express one thing, it means it excludes another. So it raises the issue of then what victims don't have their religious rights. So when you do say things, I'm not making a judgment whether they're necessary or not, but you say things that are symbolic or aren't particularly necessary, it could result in that same right not being established in other contexts, or the interpretation that, well, there are some victims who maybe can't have the religious rights. So if it's simply a statement of, you know, philosophy, you may end up with a court who's confused at some point in time as to why it was said and it wasn't said in other contexts. You know, are there burglary victims then who do not have their religious rights?
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I tend to agree with it. I agree with the purpose of the bill and the language, but when it comes to legislation, I know that Senator Rust has struggles with having similar statements made before a bill, and it's just the regular course of business that we don't put those statements in bills, maybe because of interpretation, and we just put what's easily understood and being able to interpret and enforce. So I tend to hear Mr. Fuller's legal advice as maybe this is not the appropriate place for this information because it might be open for interpretation what dignity means to someone or it doesn't really is explicitly how that would be accomplished. So I'm struggling with why we need it here because I see it similar to having it as a statement, a purpose for a bill that we regularly don't include in legislation.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I understand the committee's concern. I think it's something that, I have trained at the Mr. Fuller School of Drafting Energy Legislation, and so the words are echoing true with me. I would be happy to work on that, given the advice of the committee. If someone has suggestions or an amendment at this time to start this ball rolling, I would be open to that because it is true we shouldn't have to say things that are obvious in statute. And so if someone has a recommendation, I would be happy to take an amendment or I will continue to work on the advice of the committee.
Senator Benson, one question I had is whether or not there could be a general direction to the systems themselves to develop a policy that clearly states the victim's rights with regard to, fair treatment, something like that, so that we're not putting what their rights are in law, but rather directing the systems to have these policies. That's just off the top of my head a thought as a possible direction. Do you have a comment?
And
Mr. Fuller is telling me that actually is what the law says, but it seems that we've gone into so much detail that it's... Mr. Fuller.
Related to that, Madam Chair, you were talking about what we're telling the systems to do, and you'll notice, say, on page 1.9, the lead all, and it runs through there, that we treat the University of Minnesota differently. We don't tell them to do it. We request them to do that.
Right.
And this is an issue that may not have an autonomy basis to it when you have a general law about crime victims. It's not clear that you can only request the university to do something. So just a kernel of thought there. It might be one of those things of which there are many where, because it's not having to do with the management of their institution with respect to education, that we may have more authority over them if we chose to exercise it.
And Mr. Fuller, if you notice on the delete all two lines 1.28, 1.29, 1.30 tells our private post-secondary institutions that they must comply as well, and we generally don't tell them what to do. So in keeping with your thinking that this would be a case where if we can tell them, you would think we could tell the university.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's the sort of issue where the state has, you know, the welfare and the health of its citizens have broad general authority. And so I think with respect to any entity, there's pretty clear authority to direct them with respect to this sort of action to some extent. And so it's the nature of what we're doing, not the nature of the institution, which I think is the key issue here. And I think you're right, we can do it with the privates. We probably can do it with the U, we can do it with Minsky.
Senator Sharon?
I just agree, first of all, when we're talking, Section 3, that you could eliminate that section or the language that says requested. But I want to go back to the victims' rights. I want you to know I'm not troubled by keeping Section 2 in Subdivision 2. I think that that the section talks about requiring that a victim's rights a policy be articulated and made available, and that at a minimum, it doesn't say what is or isn't a right, it just says as a minimum, there are components that are in that policy. So I know that we're pushing this around a little bit about whether or not it needs to be or ought to be or should be in the language of the legislation, but I, for one, would support continuing to keep this in the legislation. I think it's that important.
And Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, if I don't hear amendments, I'll take Senator Sharon at her word, but I can see if there's other legislation that might mirror this and see if I can approach Senator Sharon with some language that might accomplish the goal without being in this level of detail. One of the risks that we as legislators encounter as soon as we start listing out items in detail, then whatever we exclude is specifically excluded. And so
we've
gone to the extraordinary effort of having enumerated 20 guidelines, then why don't we have 25? And so I think on the advice of the committee, I will see if there's a cleaner way to do this. And accomplish the same goal.
Yeah. Senator Benson, we actually have to resolve this here because the bill does leave to go to judiciary. So perhaps we could begin by deleting number 18, which is the most, you know, the first one that Senator Torres-Ray brought up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Chair, my intention was not to take the language out, really. I understand Senator Sharon's point, and I think it's a very important, valid point. I just wanted to make clear, you know, I'm kind of having a hard time thinking about the language that that we could put in here. I don't necessarily think it's a good idea to take it out. I'm just concerned, you know, about the way is stated. Could present, you know, some issues, but perhaps, you know, my intent. I don't know how to say more clear. I think this is okay. I think in terms of interpreting, from a legal point of view, it could present a problem in the future. But perhaps we should just leave that for a. As a statement, I think that we should think about these things very, very carefully before we put them in this form. But I know that you've done an extensive amount of work into this, so I just don't want to delete the language that you work on for so long. I don't think that's fair. I just have a problem with the way this is phrased, and I hope that if there is another chance for another stop, you can work with the staff to help kind of put the language in a way that would not present perhaps some legal problems in the future, and it presents in, you know, it might open the door for some legal interpretation that was not part of what you wanted to do. But so I am not requesting that we take this language out of the bill.
Senator Torres-Ray, our Senate counsel has advised that that particular one would that we ought to consider deleting that, so I'd like Mr. Fuller to have a chance to address that. So I think that would, in a sense, be a compromise, because then we would certainly be setting a direction with the other pieces in. And so, Mr. Fuller?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm neither for or against it. This is just, obviously. But it would be a concern that, if you read it, allowing sexual assault victims to practice their religion and exercise their civil rights without interference by the investigative criminal justice or student conduct process of the institution. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, if they have committed a crime, can the criminal justice system investigate it or be involved? It's so open-ended that would be the concern.
Senator Sharon?
I will make a motion to delete lines 3.13 through lines 3.15.
3.12.
4. It's allowing the sexual practice of their religion. It's number 18, right? Do I have the wrong?
Is it the amendment?
Are you on the amendment, Senator Sharon?
Oh, I'm operating now off the delete all. Excuse me.
That's okay.
So it would be allowance 3.12 through lines 3.14.
And then, Senator Sharon, then you would renumber
and
lines 315, 319, and 323 and letter accordingly. And you'd direct counsel to
That's
do that.
That's exactly right? What I was saying.
Okay. So Senator Sharon moves that. Any discussion? Senator Franzen.
Madam Chair, and I would support that because I do agree with counsel's concern. In addition, we already have laws that protect religion, freedom of religion, and we have civil rights laws. So, this is kind of redundant in terms of, it's good to have it and reiterate it, but it's already covered in law. So I don't necessarily think it dilutes the bill. So I would support it, but I do want to go back to 2.10 when we're done with
okay,
this.
Okay, so let's first vote on this amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Franzen.
Thank you. And for lines 2.10, I think it's vague. I agree with Senator Torres-Ray bringing it up in terms of, what does dignity mean? And it might be better to maybe consider eliminating that one line 4, 2.10, and maybe on make an amendment on line 2.12 at the end to kind of incorporate what you're trying to say in 2.10, and maybe it's to deliver those services appropriate for dealing with such incidents. So it brings in trying to appropriately work with victims without using the reference of dignity, but maybe more of how you would deal with those incidents that are so traumatic. So maybe working on some language there.
And Senator Benson, and I believe Senator Claussen has a comment on that too. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Franzen, if you look at the end of line 2.11, fair and respectful, I think the dignity is encompassed in that. And so if you wanted to remove line 10 and renumber the sections and internal references, I think that would be understandable. I think there are a number of other provisions that could be considered as part of that fair and respectful language, mm-hmm. and so I'm open to that.
So, Madam Chair, just removing Senator Benson, removing section 2.10, that line, because it does kind of already, it's already encompassed in the following section. I'd be fine with that. I think it does.
So before we move that, Senator Claussen, did you want to add something in that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I look at this, and I really believe these are good things that are listed 1 through 14, 15. But I review them as things that would be in a training policy. These are things that people should be trained when addressing sexual assault. And I wonder if language could be changed to address it as a training versus, that they should be informed of the policy.
Senator Claussen, that is actually what it says on page 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, and these things are in response to that policy.
But it just, Madam Chair, it says they should be informed of the policy, and I'm talking
right.
About
training. And then subdivision 8.
Yes.
Where is the 7.14. Senator Benson, you want to comment?
Yes, and Madam Chair and Senator Claussen, if you look, I believe line 8.3 refers, maybe that's not it. Training shall include information about topics including but not limited to, I'm just trying to make sure I have my internal references correct.
Right.
That is not the correct internal reference. I apologize.
It was, Senator Benson.
It was. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it actually does reference back to subdivision 2, which is this list.
And so, Senator Claussen, I think the training does encompass this. I would ask the question. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't wait to be acknowledged. The question before the committee at this moment, I believe, is Senator Franzen's point that fair and respectful, the terms on page 2, line 11, could encompass a number of the items that are enumerated. And so I think the question is, should we continue to enumerate a few of those items that seem to be just fair and respectful behavior, or should we eliminate them and let fair and respectful be the guidance and the institutions go into detail?
Well, Senator Benson, I think Senator Franzen's motion, if Senator Franzen would like to make that now, does really deal with the one that is most related with the deletion of line 2.12 and renumbering accordingly. So, Senator Franzen, would you like to?
I'd like to move to strike 2.10, Madam Chair, and then renumber that section accordingly.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Benson, I have a couple questions, and I apologize. I was out in the hall with some meetings, so if you've already addressed it, I'd like to hear. But it's a serious enough issue that I do want to at least get some input on this. You know, sexual assault is a serious issue, and it's a growing concern on college campuses. So I appreciate you bringing this legislation forward. And my question is of a high-level question. It really has to do about adjudicating complaints. And so one of the concerns has been that women report rapes to their college campus, whatever that mechanism is, and yet the adjudication, how does that work with a college campus adjudicating what could be a felony that would end in prison, whereas the campuses, they have a very limited arsenal of how they can address these serious crimes. And I noticed in Section 10, Subdivision 8, it was when you were talking about comprehensive training, but it does talk about the campus administrators responsible for investigating or adjudicating complaints of sexual assault. And so I'm concerned about campuses and campus staff taking on an adjudicating role in something as serious as sexual assault. And I'm just wondering if this committee has had that discussion.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is always the victim's right to report the crime to the police, but they are not compelled to report. However, under Title IX, if there is an incident that occurs on campus, the college is required to do an investigation. it is not, they are not required to report it to the police. That remains with the victim. And I think I'll let the testifiers go further before I wade into areas where I might get myself in trouble.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Palmer,
Senator Nelson. There are different processes at different colleges, too. Some of them have different ways of going about the adjudicative process. I definitely hear what you're saying. That's a very serious issue. But students are afforded due process on campus. Now, it's at a different standard than it would be if they went into the criminal court. They're not going to be looking for beyond a reasonable doubt. They're going to be looking for preponderance of evidence. So the student will be afforded due process in both sides. And part of the way of, I think, getting campus officials to look at this even more seriously is providing really robust training. And you'll see in this particular bill that it's very detailed, and we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a quickie training, that they really went into a lot of details about the dynamics of sexual assault so that they would be able to adjudicate in a very well-informed process. But it does differ from place to place, and as mentioned before, certainly the victim does have the criminal justice system as another option, too, but campuses do need to respond under their federal obligations.
Mm-hmm. And to address the point, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator
yes,
Nelson.
Ms. Stengler.
Students at the University of Minnesota, or at least the victims that we've talked to, oftentimes, if not 80% of the time, you know the perpetrator. And so there is an inherent lack of interest in bringing it to the police because of what might result, you know, a lifetime in prison isn't something with someone that you know, sometimes, not always, at a party that wants to be the punishment. And so really a lot of victims come forward and they want some form of justice. They want that individual at the very least to be compelled to not be able to contact them or to not be in the same classes as them or to be, you know, removed from campus until they're no longer there. And so it circles back to the fact that the victim has the right to do that, and there are federal guidelines that require that. But for the most part, it really is the fact that victims don't always want to bring it to the criminal justice system because they don't want to escalate it to that level because it is a very close and personal issue. And if you think about the University of Minnesota and how tight-knit certain communities are, particularly the Greek community, that can be a very dangerous thing to report to the police. And so if you can do it in a confidential setting to your university and be able to adjudicate it at a different level of preponderance of evidence and know that person might be removed from campus or suspended or get some other form of punishment that isn't jail, you're much more likely to bring that forward because you're looking for your own safety. And so that's what we have heard. I respect and understand and sympathize and even agree with a lot of the concerns, but for the most part, they're things that are well outside of the state's purview.
Senator Nelson.
I appreciate those perspectives, and I still have some concern, though, that I don't know that the campus can adequately or the higher education institutions can adequately adjudicate for sexual assault. And so I'm all about empowering students to make these reports. I am concerned that in reporting to the campus victims' rights office or whatever that reporting agency is, that I'm concerned that it might not adequately address the adjudication issues that should be in play. But I wondered if you I'm very concerned to hear that a student might not feel they can report a sexual assault to the police because of the Greek system. What does that mean? That's maybe I misunderstood you, but I thought that's what you said, that a student would feel more comfortable reporting to a campus entity rather than the police department, especially in tight-knit communities like the Greek system at the University of Minnesota. And that's very concerning. Mm-hmm. What does that mean exactly?
Ms. Stengler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Nelson, I can clarify what I meant by that because I can understand the concern that would bring to the committee. I don't mean to say that students don't feel compelled to go to the police or they're not encouraged to go to the police as if there are institutional mechanisms to not allow that to happen. What I'm saying is that in tight-knit communities, and I use the Greek community as an example, but I think teams, sports, clubs, anything can be an example of that. You don't want to haul off someone that is influential in the community in front of the court system when in reality the outcome that you want is just that they're removed from campus. And so that's a victim's right, in our opinion, to make that decision, that distinction, that what they would like to bring forward and the level that they'd like to bring it forward is their decision. decision, and that the criminal justice system can be lengthy, it can be exhausting, and it can really detract from your scholastic interests at the university. And victims know that, and often they'll make the conscious choice to go to the university. But by no means do I mean to say that this is, you know, much more prevalent in the Greek community or is exacerbated by the Greek community, but that when there are tight communities, you might not want to bring it to the level of the criminal justice system because it's much more public in nature.
Senator Nelson. Yeah,
and thank you for that clarification. And my concern was actually for the students who felt their safety was at risk if they brought a complaint to the police in a tight-knit, if it involved someone in a tight-knit community. That's very concerning, but I don't actually think that's exactly what you meant. So thank you for clarifying that. And I also understand the point that you made that actually the justice can be swifter at the more local level in this case or at the campus level. So I think that's the time frame that you're talking about is much shorter, and I can understand why that is a very valuable characteristic. And my last question then is, do the campuses have the legal ability then to restrict, like have restraining orders? Or I think you mentioned the fact that they'd like to not have this perpetrator in a class with them or something like in the dining hall or something like that. And so my question is, do the campuses have the authority then to do a type of restraining order like that, or is that something that would require the police involvement?
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, we have a testifier who can speak very specifically to what campuses can do legally.
Ms. Stengler, before you leave, you are extremely articulate, and your testimony has been very well received, and we really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we may need you back.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. My name is Abigail Krause. I am the Associate General Counsel at the University of St. Thomas. I have practiced law in the area of higher education law for over 12 years, and so I have quite a bit of background on Title IX and can speak a little bit to these questions about adjudicative authority. So your most recent question, well, I'll go to your first question, is why are colleges adjudicating these issues? And really, there are two standards at play. There are the community standards that are at place in college and university campuses. This is part of our code of conduct. It's a very serious breach of a university's code of conduct when a student commits a sexual assault. And so the adjudication that is done by a college or university is not adjudicating a crime. There are not criminal penalties that can be attached. Rather, we are determining whether our policy has been violated and what appropriate sanctions can be issued. And for a student, the most severe sanction in most cases is expulsion, and that's the limit of sanctions at the college and university level. A sexual assault that happens on campus or that's committed by a student can go through both the criminal and the college process, and we encourage students to go forward and to report to the police. But as Ms. Strangler testified, there are a number of reasons why victims choose not to go to the police, and if they make that choice, we still allow them to go through our system. We support them in going through our system, and we need to, under federal law, we are required to provide them a non-discriminatory environment and to process these complaints when they are made. Your second question was, what authority do colleges have to issue a restraining order? The restraining orders we can issue are not the same as what a police might be able to issue, and I can't speak to what the University of Minnesota or MNSCU can do because they are public institutions. At private institutions, our public campus safety offices can issue no trespass orders. We can bar a person from coming onto our private property, our campus property. We also make all sorts of arrangements to protect a victim from having any contact with the perpetrator. If the perpetrator remains a student on campus, we can make sure they're not in the same classes, not in the same residence hall. So there's a lot we can do to protect someone who comes forward with a complaint.
Thank you very much. Very clarifying. I greatly appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Ms. Krause, as long as you're here, I have a separate question for you.
Okay.
It has to do with the online reporting, subdivision 5 on page 4.
Yes.
So the bill directs the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the University of Minnesota to provide an online reporting system.
Mm-hmm.
The not-for-profit privates or privates in general are not required to do this. Do you do this? Is there, if we were to pass this law, as I understand it, that perhaps the wide variety of various privates would make it difficult to demand it, but do you foresee that your institution would comply with that?
The University of St. Thomas is the largest private institution in Minnesota. We have online reporting systems that students can use for crime. We don't currently encourage them to use it for sexual assaults. Our policy doesn't talk about it, but we feel that on our campus this is a change that we could make quite easily. I think for smaller campuses, this could be a real burden because they don't yet have an online reporting system that they could use for this purpose.
And Ms. Krause, I guess the other thing, but it does say that the system must permit anonymous reports, but mm-hmm. that is, of course, such a challenge when you're dealing with this, is how do you protect the privacy in an online reporting system?
Right, and there are a number of online reporting systems that are set up to protect the privacy. When you're reporting a sexual assault, the system might protect the privacy, but if you're giving enough details for the institution to actually do something about it, chances are you're not going to remain anonymous. So one concern we do have with this is that if we are getting anonymous reports, it may not be enough information for us to act upon it, and yet we know that something very bad has happened and we want to act upon it. So it is a real challenge with anonymous reporting.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, the anonymous report is really so that a victim can take that first step. If you'll notice, let's see, page 4, line 32, provided that the institution is not obligated to investigate an anonymous report unless a formal report is submitted through the process established in the institution's sexual harassment and violence policy or otherwise required by law. And so if someone reported anonymously in a date and time, then maybe they would be able to be matched up, but it's really about in that moment when someone might feel ready to report something that they start that conversation. It's not a tool for moving forward in some sort of formal way. It's so that the victim gets their voice out and gets comfortable talking about it.
And at least some online reporting systems have mechanisms so that the person receiving the report can correspond with them. So if it was just a report that I have been assaulted, the person receiving that report could let them know about resources on campus, let them know how to come forward, encourage them to come forward.
Well, Ms. Gross, that's helpful because I was actually concerned that if it wasn't a two-way street that you might then limit the victim taking the next step because they may feel some sort of relief having put something down and then move on rather than have it be essentially a catalyst for action. Mm-hmm. Ms. Palmer.
Senator Bonathan, and I would agree. I think the intention behind this is that it's a give and take, that somebody brings the information, they get resources back. It's absolutely that first toe in the water, and maybe they're referred over to advocacy and they go deeper at that point. But it does often take victims many times before they feel like they can really sit down and talk to somebody. Also, I think this recognizes, and we all know this, that young people are online more. They use texting. They use lots of different electronic forms of communication, and they may, frankly, be more comfortable with this.
Too. Thank you. Other testifiers? Are there people in the audience who would like to testify? Anyone from Minsky? The university? Nobody wants to say anything. Okay. Oh, Senator Nelson?
Yeah, I just had one more question on the reporting, the anonymous reporting. If, in fact, and I suppose it's different in each setting, but I would hope that if, in fact, while the person experiencing the assault might be anonymous, but they talk about who the person was that assaulted them, and if in those reports that particular name recurred a number of times and yet they were all anonymous reports, I would hope there would be some ability to look a little further because oftentimes there's not just one victim, there are many victims. And is that possible? Does this language allow for that to take place?
I think so. All institutions are required to have a Title IX coordinator, who is a person who oversees the institution's compliance with Title IX. Title IX coordinators need to keep track of all reports, including anonymous reports that came through. So I think the Title IX coordinator, and the Title IX coordinator looks for patterns. So I think if we kept getting anonymous reports with a particular individual, we would at least be able to identify that pattern. Now, students also have due process rights, and so before we could take action against that individual, we would likely need to have a complainant come forward, and yet there would be a lot we could do just with that information.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd just like Senator to move Franzen. The bill. We're ready.
Actually, we do have another question. Senator Benson, line 8.30 to 8.31, the victim of sexual assault shall decide whether to report an incident of sexual assault to campus authorities or local law enforcement. Why is that in the bill?
Madam Chair, and perhaps Ms. Palmer can elaborate, but the right of report always remains with the victim. No one can compel them. An official from the institution can't report to the police on their behalf, is my understanding. But.
And Senator Bonoff, Madam Chair, I would agree with that. We absolutely uphold that in many parts of our law, that it is the victim's choice about how they would like to proceed. And so we believe, again, that this is an important thing to mention in this report, because there is sometimes confusion about that still.
It's a little hard for me to understand how there could be confusion, because it's always our right. I mean, as human beings, we always have a right. So, Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, the testifier, the concern would be if you had a minor and, you know, PSEO or something at a campus, and they reported something to somebody, and I'm not familiar with the reporting law totally, with somebody who had a duty to report something. Would this language override that duty to report? Is that the intent?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Fuller, there are mandated reporting laws for youth. So if, for example, a young person was 16, 17 years old and in PSEO, and potentially something came up, that could potentially be a mandated report, and there would be people at the school who are mandated reporters with regard to child abuse.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, I think, and I don't want to do anything on the fly, but it may be prudent to look at them and see if there should be some language that makes that clear in the bill, because it's clear that the bill intends to retain a great deal of rights with the victim, you know, and so would I think it would be good to give some thought to whether or not that might impinge on the duty to report. Somebody may not report because they would look at that language and say, you know, which governs?
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, I want to thank Mr. Fuller, and Ms. Krause brought up the same point that we might need clarifying language for mandatory reporters. So if Mr. Fuller had suggestions for language, or if...
Well, Senator Benson, given your next stop is judiciary, and that's in their purview, Mr. Fuller, could I ask you to speak to counsel of judiciary to make sure we get that covered? Yes, that's affirmative. So so we'll ask you as well, Senator Benson, but we've got it covered with counsel. So thank you very much. So now, Senator Franzen. Senator Franzen moves Senate file 1300 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to judiciary. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Benson, and all those who came to testify and those who have worked on the bill. So next, we have Senator Peterson. And so the university and Minsky, who did not come to the table, we understand that you are in agreement and all good. So thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Before you is Senate File 1273, which establishes a competitive grant program for alternative teacher preparation programs in the state. As many of the members know, we have had some issues over the last decades, really, with bringing in a diverse teaching pool, a high-quality, diverse a slate of new teaching candidates. There are some programs that have existed that have been a tremendous success at doing just that. One of them is Teach for America. They're here today to speak in support of this bill. I would say, though, however, I debated about how I would approach the issue, and out of respect for the intelligence of the members of the committee, I will acknowledge the fact that Teach for America right now stands to be the beneficiary of this bill, and I'm not going to hide behind that fact. However, as expressed by the governor in his veto of a provision that was a direct appropriation to Teach for America, I do see the merit in establishing a competitive grant program over a direct appropriation. I think what it does is send a signal to other folks who are trying to innovate in the teacher prep space that they too can be a part of an alternative pathway into the field, and that can only stand to benefit the broader community of education interests and students ultimately. What I think is unique and exciting about this program is that I believe it's the most student-centric in its goals, in that if you look at members line 1.21, these programs actually have to have a proven track record of improving student achievement. That actually would set it apart from any other teacher prep program in the state. And I think it's a small appropriation to allow a group or groups to bring forward innovative ways to prepare our next generation of teachers. With that said, Madam Chair, I do have a small technical amendment. The A1 amendment, do the members have that? I'd like to move that as an author's amendment.
Very good. We do have that. So Senator Peterson moves the A1. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, with that, I'll turn it over to the Executive Director of Teach for America.
Senator Peterson, you want to just briefly state what your amendment does?
It just changes, as you can see, some very basic language from appropriation to grant. And then it was actually at the suggestion of staff. So I think it's just a rewording of that sentence on 10 and 11. I don't think
it
makes a substantive change to the
bill. Okay, thank you. Yep. And Senator Peterson, as I understand it, there actually might be other potential grantees. So while the bulk of this activity currently is Teach for America, we'll find out.
Yeah, and I think that's the benefit of having the competitive grant program over a direct appropriation, is that over time we will actually bring it, I would imagine, other interests forward that want to operate in the space and take advantage of the program. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Mr. Hercodley.
Madam Chairwoman and committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Anil Hercodley, and I'm the Executive Director for Teach for America here in the Twin Cities. On behalf of Teach for America, I am asking you to support Senate File 1273 because there's a need to fund and expand programs that offer alternative pathways to teaching in Minnesota. As a state, we must do everything within our power to identify and train great, diverse teachers who will ensure that every student is on a path towards college, career, and life success. That means that supporting our alternative pathways to teaching, in addition to supporting our traditional teacher prep programs, must be a priority. TFA contributes to the important work of ensuring every student receives an excellent education by recruiting top college grads and seasoned professionals to commit to teach at least 2 years in high-need schools and to then become lifelong advocates for educational equity, inside and outside of the classroom. Today in Minnesota, we have 68 classroom teachers in their first 2 years as core members and 149 teachers in their third year or more of teaching. And that amounts to an impact on roughly 12,000 students daily. I will add that last year, 90% of our second-year teachers committed to teach for a third year. The way in which we select teachers is rigorous, it's comprehensive, and it's based on research on what traits we know lead to great teachers. It's unique because it's an admissions process based on data from our most successful teachers. We look at the traits that they demonstrated in the admissions process, and we incorporate that data into our ongoing admissions process to ensure that we're measuring the right things. And so I'll give you a rundown of what these traits include. The first is a deep belief in the potential of all students without exception, a demonstrated leadership ability across a variety of settings, strong achievement in academic, professional, extracurricular, and volunteer settings, perseverance in the face of challenges, a long-term commitment to reaching goals in various settings, excellent critical thinking skills, excellent organizational abilities, excellent interpersonal skills, and respect for individuals' diverse experiences, and the ability to work effectively across lines of difference. This past year, TFA sought to strengthen its effectiveness in teacher prep and ongoing support by partnering with the U of M to create an alternative teacher prep program. As a nationally recognized teacher preparation program, the University of Minnesota has helped us strengthen and refine our two-year professional development trajectory, and it's improved our ability to recruit and matriculate strong, diverse teacher candidates. The diversity of our state's teaching force matters because it's important to our increasingly diverse student population. There are undeniable academic and social benefits which have shown us that diversity is the central tenet of a strong teaching force. That makes the fact that only 3.5% of our state's teaching force identifying as people of color that much more urgent of an issue to address. Of the group of new teachers who entered Twin Cities classrooms this fall through TFA, over half identified as people of color or coming from a low-income background. That important trend will continue with our new teachers entering classrooms this fall. I want to close my remarks by sharing one example from our current class of teachers who are in their first year, and I believe she exemplifies why alternative pathways are so important to support alongside traditional teacher preparation programs. This incoming core member grew up in North Minneapolis and was considered a visionary by her peers for simply starting a sentence, "When I go to college." A graduate of Gustavus, she believes that growing up in North Minneapolis and experiencing exactly how educational inequity plays out here will help her be a more culturally competent and effective teacher who can empower her students to see themselves as the leaders our community needs. And we agree. Let me be clear. We support strengthening all teacher preparation programs and improving our investments in alternative teacher prep programs through competitive grant making. We ask that you support Senate File 1273. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any idea how many teachers we could train with this amount of money in the grant?
So I can talk a bit about the demand for our teachers, which we believe grant funding would allow. We see openings for hard-to-place certification areas all over the state. In the Twin Cities right now, we believe that we could place probably approximately double what we place right now, which would be in the area of 70 to 80 teachers for an incoming class, whereas we're currently planning to place 30 next year.
Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peterson, other than TFA, are there other organizations that you're aware of that would qualify? Can you give the committee some ideas of other organizations that are out there or any landscape?
Madam Chair, Senator Franson, it's my understanding there are a few programs in their infancy right now that are working on it. There's none that currently do, and that's why I acknowledge at the outset that was the case, that I wanted to be upfront with the committee about this is a still relatively new area of statute, and there are folks. Teach for America has the benefit and has earned the pedigree that has allowed them to become one of the earliest, you know, adopted prep programs under the statute under 122A. And so, no, the answer is no. I don't know of any currently right now.
But, Senator Franson, I believe we have a testifier who also wanted to speak from Minneapolis. Who was some intention to be in that area? So. Perhaps now's a good time. And I know, Ms. Christ, you want to speak in opposition, so let's have the testifiers in support first, and then we'll get to you.
Yeah. Let me scoot over here. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Molly Sullivan. I am the Grow Your Own Coordinator for Minneapolis Public Schools, which means I work to identify pathways to licensure for our internal talent who don't have teaching licenses. And I just want to take a second to say that with a name like Molly Sullivan, I feel like it would be right to acknowledge that it's St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Ms. Sullivan. And we love the green. We have other green around the table.
People in the room are doing a good job representing the holiday. So I oversee the Minneapolis Residency Program, which we are currently awaiting Minnesota Board of Teaching approval for our program, and we are not would not be an alternative certification program. Mm-hmm. We would fall under the non-conventional category. But I'd like to take just a brief moment to talk about the residency program and our efforts to diversify our teaching workforce. So the district believes strongly in alternative and non-conventional programs, as well as traditional/conventional programs to teacher licensing. I want to thank Senator Peterson for bringing this bill forward. We would encourage the committee to consider including other non-conventional programs for licensure in this bill. So as I said, at this time, the program that I'm developing wouldn't qualify to apply for the grant should the funding be approved. The goal of the Minneapolis Residency Program is to expand and diversify the teaching workforce by drawing from our internal talent, so namely our education support professionals. There are education assistants in the classrooms who currently work in our schools with our students. And we have an emphasis on recruiting bilingual candidates. The program is being designed in partnership with MFT, the University of Minnesota, and Minneapolis Public Schools. Our primary reasons for recruiting from this pool is that they already work, as I said, every day with our students in our schools. They see the life and work of a teacher, and they're hoping to become a teacher one day themselves. And they're a diverse group. 41% of them are identify as people of color, and 11% are bilingual. The main barrier that these candidates perceive in pursuing their license is the 6-month unpaid student teaching internship. So our program would provide a stipend to these residents while they focus on the work of becoming a teacher, not fulfilling a dual role of being a support professional and a teacher candidate. We'd also provide health insurance while they're students. They'll be paired with a co-teacher for a year-long co-teaching residency. And we're excited about this pipeline to teaching. We support multiple pathways to licensure. We believe that Teach for America is one of those pathways. MPS currently has 20 Teach for America teachers in our classrooms. And we believe that having multiple pathways, both alternative and non-conventional, in addition to conventional licensures, would provide greater opportunity to diversify our teaching workforce and improve outcomes for our students. So thank you for your time.
Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair, I think you know what you heard was just a reaffirmation of the value of non-traditional pathways into teaching. Minneapolis Public Schools has constructed a program that doesn't necessarily conform with the Alternative Teacher Preparation Program statute. However, it's just another great example of districts and communities getting together to find better ways to get folks involved in the district. So as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the Minneapolis Public School program still results in a traditional license, I think, would be maybe one of the differences between the two programs.
Ms. Sullivan?
Madam Chair and committee members, the senator's correct. These people would be obtaining an elementary education license.
Sounds like Ms. Sullivan is suggesting that you consider saying alternative and non-traditional. Is that the essence of the words that you used, Ms. Sullivan?
Yes. My understanding is that my program would be classified as non-conventional. So I would love for that to be added to the bill.
It's a non-conventional traditional licensure program.
Got it. Any other? Yes, Senator Sharon.
Were you saying, Senator, that in order to accommodate to the request, we would need to add on line 1.14 some language describing the non-conventional teacher preparation program?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I wasn't suggesting amending the bill.
No, I didn't think you were. But I was asking Senator Bonoff in order to accommodate to that request, we would have to add language such as that to this.
Right.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, and I would, as I told Minneapolis Public Schools, I was made aware of this program a couple days ago. And while we're all very familiar and have a decades-long track record to look at the Teach for America program, I have just heard about it. And so I haven't had, I don't believe anybody has had the time from a policymaking standpoint to learn about the Minneapolis Public Schools program or anything like that. And so my desire was to try to keep that conversation going by allowing them to come up and speak and tell us about their program, but maybe hear about that in a more comprehensive way sometime down the road.
Senator Marv, I understand that would be the senator's perspective, but the committee can decide whether or not they would like to add that language to the bill at some point as we continue with the testimony here.
Absolutely. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In that vein as well, the concern I have with the bill or the issue I have with the bill is that it establishes a competitive grant program for just one organization. So then, in essence, it's not competitive. So let's just call it an appropriation because it's not a competitive grant program. So that's my adding language like that makes it competitive because we have more than one. If we can't identify more than one eligible grantee, then it's not competitive. So I have that concern, and I don't know if we want to fix that now or just call it what it is.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, Senator Franzen, I think practically speaking, you're right under the current circumstances. However, I think the fundamental difference between the two things is that you can create the conditions in the statute by which other people will identify the grant program and therefore begin to build the program of their own in order to qualify under the conditions, because as it's written, it's not exclusive to a particular program. So that in passage of this bill, there's going to be undoubtedly a whole bunch of other folks who want to take advantage of the program and therefore will do so. It'd be like establishing, and this is a very, very overly simplified example, but the establishment of a charter school law to legalize charter schools when you only knew of one authorizer at the time who wanted to do so. It's not a statute that's specific to that charter school. It's just, it's an early, the law was just adopted. There have been as many very highly publicized issues in getting these programs on track. And so we're still early, and we'd like to move towards a competitive grant program that would encourage maybe a more robust ecosystem of these sorts of programs. I think that's the difference.
Senator Franzen, I would just also point out that alternative teacher preparation program is defined in statute, and so what this bill does is it allows for a funding mechanism for those programs that have been approved by the Board of Teaching under the alternative teacher preparation statute. And so I think the problem at this point we would have for the non-conventional is I don't think we have that defined in statute.
Correct.
And so it would be premature in that sense. Certainly something the committee could keep talking about, but I think the Board of, as Senator Klassen pointed out quietly to me, the Board of Teaching ultimately has to approve these programs.
Sure, Madam Chair, I understand that, but we're saying it's going to be competitive when we know, in fact, that it's not. And that's that. I mean, I think that's a fact.
Senator
so that's my
Franzen,
concern.
It says an alternative teacher preparation grant program. So we're
on line point 1.13.
So would you, Senator Franzen, would you be more comfortable if the word competitive was stricken?
Madam Chair, let me mull over that. I'm still trying to see what would make me more comfortable with the bill. But I know the intention. It's to have these funds and resources available for the work that is being done, which I don't necessarily have a big issue with. We need to do the work that we need to in terms of diversifying our workforce in the teaching profession especially, and making sure that we deal with the lack of teachers that, people are leaving the profession as well. So if this is going to help, I'm open to it. I'm trying to be as a lawyer trying to see, like, have an issue with calling it something that it really isn't.
Yep, I understand. I hear you. Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Peterson, I appreciate what you're trying to do here, but along the lines, I have the same concerns that Senator Franzen has expressed, in part because it's sort of, you know, 1.16 and the criteria that are enumerated. These programs would already have to have a highly selective process. They would have to have a history of selecting participants. They are established teacher preparation models with a track record. So it sort of seems that by definition that is at odds with fostering these new and upcoming programs that don't yet have histories. So I feel like this is part of the bind that we're in with the competitive grant program and what you've described, which, you know, is certainly worth further discussion.
Thank you.
Madam Senator Chair, Senator Kent, it is possible under current law that an alternate program would actually exist on an individual case-by-case basis. So up until the broader program within TFA was approved at the University of Minnesota, TFA still operated. They just went through the very, very time-consuming process of getting each one of their teachers made an exception for. And one might be able to argue that that process has made TFA better at what they're doing in navigating that process. I don't know. But certainly it would be a barrier to entry that would require these organizations to prove time and time again that their teachers were, in fact, capable of doing the work. I would say, again, there is a difference between mandating an appropriation and just complying with a program that's outlined in statute. The teacher prep, the ALTS prep program statute is not specific to Teach for America. And if we want people in the future to be able to participate in this, you would go with a competitive grant program versus a direct appropriation. Direct appropriation does nothing for anybody who wants to get into this field in the future. So,
members, that when the veto message on the bill that I authored last time, the governor said specifically that the reason was because it was a direct appropriation, and that he requested that if in the future we were to go forward, that it be a competitive grant program. So for those who have followed this issue, it has been very painstaking to get an alternative preparation program through the Board of Teaching. That has finally happened. The partnership between the University of Minnesota and Teach for America is very strong, and that's working. The hard part is when something's alternative, it doesn't have a ready-made funding system. It's not a traditional teacher prep program within a system whereby it's getting funding. And so while this TFA core is expanding their diversified teacher pool and really having just outstanding outcomes, they're hamstrung. So Senator Peterson has brought forward the competitive grant approach. But let's hear from another quarter, Ms. Christ.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Cindy Christ, representing the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. Assuming that the purpose of this bill is to support innovative approaches to prepare a high-quality, diverse teaching force with the skills, knowledge, and dispositions needed to support student learning at a high level, we would like to express our support for the concept, but identify what we see as a number of flaws in the bill as written, some of which have just been raised. Two of those involve definitions, and the others involve the eligibility criteria. Under definitions for diversity, and this doesn't exactly speak to the substance of the conversation to date, but we would like to suggest consideration of rewording that definition. First of all, when we talk about diversity, I don't think we usually refer to types of people. I think definitions of diversity more often would speak to something like the inclusion of individuals representing more than one race, ethnic group, nation of origin, and so on. In this case, we might also want to include socioeconomic status and the native language of the candidate. So that's kind of more a matter of semantics than the concept being presented here, but I think an important one. Secondly, the definition of highly selective as simply a percentage of applicants. There's nothing about that definition that's going to guarantee quality. While obviously many factors generally go into selecting a pool, I'm going to give you a very simplified example just to make the case for why I don't think a percentage is really a good definition of quality. So let's imagine two programs, each with 100 candidates. Obviously, I'm trying to make the mathematics simple so we don't get caught up in that. So two programs, each have 100 candidates. One, all of their candidates present a GPA of 2.5. The other one, all of the candidates present a GPA of 3.5 or higher. Under this definition, the first program would admit up to 25% of the candidates with a 2.5. The second program would have to turn away candidates at a higher level than that first pool of candidates. In other words, they would be turning down candidates with GPAs of 3.5 or higher. So simply a percentage of applicants accepted is not a good definition or proxy of quality. Then, in terms of establishment and eligibility, and this is what was just discussed, if the means to a stated end is truly a competitive grant process, and this is only funded for 2 years, then we believe that the bill needs to be revised to make other potential programs eligible. I would submit that if the criteria for selection are strong, then we would not need to worry about who the potential applicants could be, because any program that could demonstrate it's met the stated criteria could be considered. And so within that context, of course, what our institutions would love to see, even though most of their programs technically are considered traditional, they vary widely. As many of you may know, they've changed a great deal over time. So we would love to see the limitation to an alternative teacher preparation program as defined under statute removed, and the competition open to any applicants who, again, as I said, could demonstrate that they met the criteria. And in fact, I think it's kind of interesting that the third criteria currently specifies that this alternative program has to be an established teacher preparation model. So it doesn't appear that the author is saying this has to be a very new program. However, I recognize that the author probably would not accept that idea. So another option would be what Ms. Sullivan suggested, and I know Dr. Deborah Dillon, who's an associate dean at the University of Minnesota, presented this idea last week in the House. And that is to open the definition beyond alternative teacher preparation programs as defined in statute and be somewhat more broader. And there, one of the things that might be included is non-conventional programs. The U of M Grow Your Own residency program is an example. We think TC2, which is the Bush-funded program among six private institutions in the Twin Cities, a number of our post-baccalaureate programs, and MSU Mankato's originally Bush-funded Teachers for Tomorrow might fit a broader definition. Again, under this, under a competitive program, they would still have to demonstrate to the Office of Higher Education. They'd still have to provide proof of being highly selective, selecting participants that would increase the diversity of our teaching workforce, and have a track record or somehow be able to demonstrate improved student achievement. Just two other very quick points that I would make. One is that there's a reference in that third criteria to local or national research. And I just want to point out as an example here, some might question the value of that criteria, frankly, in assessing Teach for America, for the reason that TFA's Minnesota program is, I believe, significantly different from programs elsewhere. So the findings of research on programs outside of Minnesota may or may not be relevant for Minnesota's program. And we would also suggest consideration, at some point at least, as a criteria, some attention to sustainability of the program, so that funding once or twice wouldn't be one of those cases where when the funding goes away, so does the program, and also potentially the retention of candidates prepared in the program. Schools have a much harder time achieving ongoing and consistent sustainable improvements in student achievement when there's rapid turnover in the teaching force. So if not now, at some point, if this competitive grant program is put in place, retention of candidates might want to be considered. And then finally, the language under use of the grant, just point out that it's customary with grant programs to specify a limit of the amount of the appropriation that can be used for management and operation. And I would think if you want to be certain that the majority of this funding actually supports the recruitment efforts outlined here, ongoing professional development and so on, you might want to put in place, if this is funded, a limit in terms of the percentage of the funding that you would be appropriating that could be spent for management. So, again, we believe that if the criteria could be rewritten to maintain the focus on the goals that Senator Peterson has in mind, but in a way that would make it truly a competitive opportunity, we think that is well worth considering.
Thank you, Ms. Chris. I sense that you have become more favorable than you were 2 years ago. It may not sound like it in aggregate, but...
Well, Madam Chair, I think I said 2 years ago that there's much to admire in Teach for America. I think they have really, done some very innovative and effective things focusing on the use of data. I think the work they've done focusing on leadership is just excellent work. And I know that there are a number of public and private institutions across the country who have picked up that work and incorporated into theirs. Some of them were probably doing it before Teach for America, but the conversation, I think, was focused on it more through Teach for America. But I'm also choosing today not to try to revisit old arguments that many of you have heard me make in the past, but rather to focus on this particular bill and its effort to provide competitive grant opportunities.
Thank you. Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would say, first of all, I haven't met with Mrs. Christ or anybody from MACT to this point. I've had no meeting requests as far as I know with regard to new language suggestions, so it's difficult for me to work. Made a presumption about what position I may have about a particular issue, yet I guess on the surface I'm not offended by what you suggested. So what I'm saying is I haven't been given the opportunity to work with MACD on the suggestions, some of which I think have merit. So I think the point that we're trying to make in the construction of the bill is that there's something different about this PREP program, that we spend hundreds of millions of dollars in other areas of teacher preparation in this state, and those programs have none of these standards. And while I appreciate the concern about the standards outlined in the bill, I should say, I would say that this is a very, very small appropriation in an area relative to the overall work that's being done in a particularly around a program that has had a great track record and allows other people to do that. But if there's language suggestions, usually I like to get that work done before the committee hearing.
Well, Senator Peterson, we are in a situation where because it is an appropriation, it's a finance bill, and so what we could do if members would give Senator Peterson the leeway is to pass the bill and to finance, and then with the understanding that when the bill comes back up in finance, which it will have to do anyway, that you'll have a chance to have made whatever changes you're willing to make, and then the committee can consider the bill fresh.
Absolutely.
Senator Franzen.
Madam Chair, I have issue with saying that $2 million is not a lot of money when we're struggling for every penny to do the investments we have to do, especially in education. I remember battle last biennium of $4 million for scholarships, so this is half of that money, essentially. So this is a lot of money, and we have to take it seriously, every single dollar that we use for these programs. I'm not ready to support it at this time. I think it's premature, and I think there's work to do. There's a lot of things. I agree with the second testifier. Not everything, but there's a lot of issues there that if they're addressed and when it comes back to finance, I could be open to supporting it, because I do believe you're doing a great job as well with what I've heard, TFA, and I want to make sure that you continue to do that great job, but I just don't feel comfortable with calling it something that's not until we have some language that actually makes it competitive And if that's addressed, I'd be open to supporting it when it comes back to finance, but at this point, I'm not.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really support the idea of opening it up so we can get a broader group of people that could apply for this. I think innovation is very important, and trying new things and thoughts and supporting that is good. I'd also like for you to consider, Senator Peterson, evaluation, that we actually do an evaluation on the program. I realize, you know, if it goes through, we've got a track record of Teach for America, but on the other hand, we're also expanding their capacity, and I think a proper evaluation would be good for the future.
Ms. Crist.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I just want to apologize to you for not having talked to you about this before. I am MACD's only lobbyist, and I'm very part-time, and I think you all know how many bills have been introduced in both bodies this year about licensure. So, but I do apologize that we didn't bring these to you earlier, and we'd be very happy to work with you from this point forward. And if I could just also say, we do have programs at our institutions focused on the same criteria that are in the bill here. They may not focus on them exactly the way TFA does, but for example, Mankato's Teachers for Tomorrow focuses very significantly on increasing the diversity of the teaching force. We have a number of programs that have highly selective processes for admission. So there are other programs, traditional programs, with these same goals. They may not be packed. Well, they're not. Not may. They're not packaged the same way the TFA is, but they do have those goals.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. My feedback would be, first of all, the criteria on the measurement of the criteria, you know, line 2.11 on the second page, Senator Peterson says that it refers to the report for the grantee to share compliance with the criteria. And it's the criteria that, you know, for example, one is that you have used, the criteria is that you've used a highly selective process. That's not what I would like to hear about, whether or not you used a highly selective process. I'd like the second one, that you've selected participants that increase, that you have, in fact, increased the diversity. You know, so the criteria that we want to see as an outcome from the grant needs strengthening to make sure that we're clear about what we want to achieve. This is your criteria for selecting the participants or the eligibility for the grant ought not be the criteria upon which we evaluate the outcome of the grant. That's one thing. Okay, then and that's not clear to me. How could we strengthen what it is we'd like to see as outcomes from any initiative, whether it's of teacher preparation? The second thing is, I think that.
Excuse me, Senator Sharon, we actually did fix that in the amendment.
Oh, we did. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Never mind. The other thing is the idea of moving this along, you know, without, really resolving some of these issues. I think at a minimum, if we were going to do that, we should resolve the question of whether we're going to expand that language for alternative preparation programs and non-conventional teacher prep programs, that we should at least give a clear direction to the senator that we have that expectation before going and doing more language smithing on the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Senator Sharon, I'm willing to do that work. However, I don't believe that I have the appropriate understanding of what those other things are. At this point, we've only heard one example, but there's actually other examples as well. And I would like to be able to, if we're going to expand it, be able to get an understanding of what those things are. If I could make a suggestion as a member of the committee, that may give some comfort to the folks who would like to be sure that this isn't going to move forward without their consent. May I suggest maybe striking the appropriation amount in 2.13 and just leaving it as an open question? That way you, in voting today, have the comfort in knowing that $2 million is not going to be appropriated and therefore effectively neuters the bill until we have a resolution. Is that something that would...
And members... we couldn't have appropriated it anyway because we're not in finance right now. And so that's why I said, and given that we are both a policy and a finance committee, it's not going anywhere. Right. And so it would still have to have the votes. And I do think Senator Peterson's hearing loud and clear that he doesn't have the votes if there isn't some change.
Senator Sharon. I think that I'm not sure what the votes are. Maybe you do have the votes. I don't know. But for my vote, I need to see an expansion of the eligibility of the competition, and that it includes such things as non-conventional teacher programs, which would mean you'd have to take out some of the language in the criteria. Under number two, you'd have to say selecting, instead of history of, you'd have to say selecting participants that increase the diversity. So, but I think in order for EU even to go, for the senator to go through and work on the language, I'd like to know if this committee by majority agrees that in order for it to move forward, it should have an expanded eligibility.
Senator Peterson.
Compete.
Madam Chair, this is a matter of gaveling out and gaveling into the committee. I know we've done that in education, for example.
Senator Peterson, that's not the point. The point is the members are unwilling at this point. Some of them are expressing an unwillingness to even pass the bill to finance because they want to know if you are going to expand your eligibility criteria.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, so technically we would need to have a floor session in between to move the bill to finance division.
Oh, right.
So what I'm suggesting, what I was thinking, Madam Chair, was you could just lay the bill over and then we could come back in one session and do it, but we can't because we have to go to floor session in order to move the bill between committees.
Yeah.
I don't think that we can amend the bill in a responsible way to Senator Sharon's point.
Senator Peterson, are you willing to expand the eligibility even though we don't know exactly what that would look like today? That's the question the members are asking you.
Yes.
I trust that. But.
I'm on the public record. I wouldn't be dishonest. If there's a solution that I don't support, I'll just simply withdraw the request for the hearing, and we won't even come back and do this exercise again.
Okay. So, Senator Nelson.
Just a couple comments. Senator Peterson, I appreciate your support of teacher quality. We know that the teacher is the number one in-school variable when it comes to student achievement, and so I think it's important to be supportive of all teacher quality initiatives, and I see this as one of those. And to build on Senator Bonhoff's comments, Teach for America does have a stellar record, and it also has a record with some of our most challenging students. And so it has a very strong track record. My comments would follow along two lines. One, I was very much listening to the testifier, Ms. Christ, about the highly selective, less than 25%. So I think there's a better way to get at highly selective than saying 25% of whoever applies to whatever. So I'm hoping you work on that. And then my bigger comment had to do with the reporting requirements. I would really like to see more robust reporting requirements here. I think there's a confusion here between what it is that we want to measure, which is the reporting requirements, and what the criteria are for the grant. And they're two different things. And so what I'd like to see is a more robust reporting requirement that is actually looking at the outputs, not the input, the output. What is it that students are achieving? Are we seeing students achieve growth? And we have the ability now to measure individual student growth. And that's what I think I would very much like to see in that reporting requirement is increased individual student growth. So those
Senator
are
Nelson, Senator
comments.
Sharon did echo those comments. Yes. So Senator Peterson moves that Senate file, what's the number? 1273 be recommended to pass and referred to finance as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Okay. Next bill. That would be the Higher Ed's Policy Bill, Office of Higher Ed's Policy Bill. So, Senator Claussen. And members, we've got two more bills, and because we're at deadline weeks, we're just going to plow through them. So.
All those in favor?
Senator Boniff, welcome to the committee. Are you ready to go?
I am. Mr. Chair, it looks like we have two amendments. You want me to start with the A1 amendment. So I would offer the A, and these are both author's amendments.
I believe the amendment is being distributed to committee members.
So we'll just, if you would, given it's an author's amendment, if we could just move them both, and then I'll talk about the bill in general, and then we'll go to the amendments.
Okay. Yes. Senator Sharon is moving the A1 and A2 amendments.
It's one at a time, one at a time.
One at a time.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1535. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
And I'll also move the A2 amendment.
Senator Sharon is moving the A2 amendment to Senate File 1535. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we have before us is the policy bill for higher ed. And if you recall, last session we had various unsessioned bills, and the Office of Higher Ed had packaged a pretty robust bill to deal with their desired unsessioned changes. And we left many of their recommendations on the cutting room floor. So we are now revisiting their recommendations, and our approach in bringing this bill forward is anything that truly was just a technical change, unsessioned change, we are leaving in this Office of Higher Ed bill. Anything that was a little more than a technical change, but one we thought there would just be easy, common sense, broad consensus, we also kept in this bill. We deleted anything out that we felt warranted more discussion. And those things, it doesn't mean we aren't going to do them. It means if we were to do them, we would put them in our policy bill. We did not want to send kind of a housekeeping bill in the office of, or in the committee's policy bill. We wanted our policy bill to actually be a substantive changes. And so there are two amendments before you. The A2 deletes all those things that we didn't accept, and I'll ask Senate Council to take you through that. And the A1, I will ask Maren to tell us what the A1 does.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, all these sections are deleted, and I'm not going to go into much detail, are ones that either would require a reference to another committee, perhaps, or have embedded policy issues which are more appropriate for the omnibus bill. So section 1 and 2 have flavor of data and reference to GovOp in section 2. Senator Claussen has the same language in his bill, which is proceeding differently with regard to section 2. Page 3, delete section 6. It was a definition, a change in a definition, which has minor substantive changes, which, again, recommended for the omnibus bill. Section 7. Again, had a minor change that was more than technical. Section 8 on page 5. Same provision, same issue. Section. So essentially, I mean, essentially, because there's really no reason to go through this except to say that they're all of the nature that they didn't seem appropriate to set out in an unsession sort of bill. And the bulk of the sections that were deleted, which is on line 12 of the amendment, is the issue of institutional termination, which is for the state grant program, which is currently in rules, and the proposal was to bring it in the statute, but it was thought that it would be best to review what those language, what that language was in rules before it was just rubber stamped and put in the law.
Any comments on the amendments? Yes, Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, sorry, Senator Clausen, we don't want to play with you. He had Section 2, which I was puzzled for why it came to my committee. So I said, okay, we're going to give you a hearing at the last minute. And then I see it here, so I just texted my staff saying I don't need to see this bill because it isn't the technical bill. And so it's going back and forth. So I would like to offer an amendment to bring this Section 2 back. It's a technical amendment that Senator Clausen, it really doesn't need to go to my committee. So I would like to offer an amendment to bring Section 2 back so you don't have to go to my committee, because there is no reason really to go to my committee. It takes more time for him to do all of this, and I don't have a reason to hear it in my committee, so I would like to offer an amendment to bring it back so that it is in the technical bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, and perhaps we could get some other advice, because I thought that the e-verify language also had to go through judiciary, and so so is council agreeing that it doesn't have to make any other stops?
Mr. Fuller, could you rule on
Mr.
this?
Mr. Advises. Chair, there's two issues then. Senator Torres-Ray, is the bill being formally then referred back to this committee, Senator Clausen's bill, or you're just not going to hear it and it's not going to be recalled?
So Mr. Fuller and Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, this was a technical bill that Senator Clausen brought, and it is higher ed's jurisdiction. I had no idea why it came to me, but I said, okay, I'll give you a hearing. So we schedule it. There is no reason for us to schedule. This is higher ed jurisdiction. So since you have it in the technical bill, I really don't need to hear it. So when I saw it here, I took it out of the agenda in my committee, thinking that since this is higher ed jurisdiction and I don't have the time for more bills, I just will take care of it here.
Mr. Chair.
Or you will take care of it.
It's Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I'll make a deal with you. It's a bill I want heard in your committee. I'll cut that deal. Just kidding. But not really.
There's a lot of bills, Senator Bonoff,
so
years that I will
hear. Senator Torres-Ray.
Just to clarify, I'm not kidding. This bill, in order to have be able to refinance student loans, we need to get this passed.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's yeah. important. Yeah. So
it's
Mr.
A very
Fuller.
Technical piece.
Mr. Chair, members, then on line 1.3 of the amendment, delete line 1.3 of the amendment, and then I assume if we don't know if the House Companion is going to pass, so I suppose this may show up in our policy bill.
It has passed.
It has passed. All right. So anyway, that's the motion, Mr. Chair. Delete 1.3 of the amendment.
So moved.
Just a question then. By making this action, if we would pass this action, what would be the outcome then?
Mr. Chair, then Section 2 would remain in this bill. It would move with this bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we not already pass the A2, so we would have to do something else?
I'm amending the amendment.
But we already passed the... Okay, so we're reconsidering.
What's the technical
I'll
thing we need to
I'll make a motion to reconsider the A2 amendment.
All right.
There we go.
We've got two motions right now that are.
I'll take my old motion off the table and replace it with a reconsideration of the A2 amendment.
Okay, and I think Senator Torres-Ray though had a motion as well.
No. We pass an amendment. The language is there, which is the leading number 2 of the amendment. So I thought the previous motion was correct, but it doesn't matter.
Whatever the motion right. is, let's just
take we have a motion to reconsider the A2 amendment on Senate File 1535. Do we have any other discussion? All those in favor of reconsidering the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? So moved.
I'd like to make an oral amendment to the A2 amendment. Or did you want to do that? Go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Senator Sharon?
I'd like to make an oral amendment to the A2 amendment, which would be to delete lines .13.
Okay. Any discussion?
Friendly amendment, Mr. Chair.
Friendly amendment. Thank you. Senator Sharon moves that we delete line 1.3 on the A2 amendment. Referencing Senate File 1535. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
And then I'd like to move the A2 amendment as amended.
Okay. Senator Sharon is moving the A2 amendment as amended. Any discussion? All those that are in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. A2 amendment as amended has been passed.
The
Senator
bill.
Bonham.
Back to the bill. So now you have before you the bill as well as the amendments that have been passed. So as amended, I'll turn it over to Mara.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Maren Henderson. I'm the legislative liaison for the Office of Higher Education. I do have with me a number of program experts, so if members have questions, I will be turning it over to some of our staff. But to briefly go over the bill as amended. Don't go through the whole thing. So just to clarify on the A1 amendment, the section that was added on line 1.3 refers to the summer transition grant program. This has been repealed because in another statute it has been moved into our intervention for college attendance program, just an administrative simplification. The rest of the changes in Article 1 are all technical changes. The reason for the majority of these changes are either to reflect current practice, to align with the work of other state agencies, or to comply with our mandate for plain language.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I'm wondering if you or your testifier could speak to the incentive programs, 2.28 and on through lines 2.31. I'm just curious about incentive programs, mm-hmm. not to exceed $25,000, but not limited to gift cards. So what are we talking about here with these incentive programs?
Ms. Henderson.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, this is one of the examples that aligns with what other state agencies do. Examples of these promotional incentives could be, for example, gift cards at the state fair booth, perhaps putting some money into a 529 plan or other loan programs, very small incentives that are primarily used for marketing of our programs that we operate. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So the gift card has some amount of money on it. I guess technically it could be up to $25,000 if there were one gift card, but I don't think that's what you mean. But this gift card would have money on it given away at the state fair booth, and for what reason exactly would the Office of Higher Education be giving away gift cards with money on them?
Ms. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, from my understanding, the primary purpose of this is to attract interest in our programs, but it sounds like we have more detail.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Helgeson. I'm the audit manager for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I apologize for my voice. The reason this was added was, again, to be consistent with other agencies, namely that one of the main examples would be the DNR, which has this specific language. We have a program, the partially federally funded program, the Get Ready program, and that's when this first arose. They wanted to put some incentives out to get better data collection from the communities they are serving with the grant. I was asked to do some research as to if we could offer some incentives to get people to respond to their questions. And when I checked the Attorney General's office, I was told that since we had no language allowing us to do that, that we were prohibited from doing so. That's when I reviewed other statutes, found places like the DNR that allows for these types of incentives to be used, and that's where that's the origin of this language.
Thank you, Mr. Helgeson. Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'm not totally convinced yet that just because the DNR has language like this, that the Office of Higher Education should, nor that the DNR language is exactly correct. I don't know. But here's my concern. I can't tell if we are giving money to the Office of Higher Education to buy data from students, that's a little bit what it sounds like, or if this is a case where we're asking, where the Office of Higher Education is actually collecting student data and giving out credit cards. I think that's way off. I think you're just talking about gift cards. But there's something here that doesn't quite smell right to me. I guess I just haven't quite figured out what it is you hope to gain with this $25,000.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Helgeson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. The specific example that the Get Ready program had was they wanted to be able to give away either an iPod or an iPad, I can't remember what now, this goes back a couple of years. There's a federal requirement to follow up and get data not only from the students that are being served but also from the parents. And these are families, lower socioeconomic families. It's not always easy to contact them and to get them to fill out these questions, which are required as part of receiving a very large federal grant, and they're supposed to get, I can't remember, it was 85-90% participation. And in order to try to reach that goal and to meet that, they asked if they could, you know, do a drawing of this type of thing. And every time, you know, whoever responded, their name would go in and there'd be a drawing. At that point, I was asked to research this, as I stated, and found that we were not authorized to do this. So the DNR can go out and give away little things to encourage take a child fishing or whatever, those types of things. I believe it's either the Health Department or Human Services also has similar language. So in my research and speaking with the AG's office, they said you need to get statutory language if you want to do anything at all like this. And the reason the gift card even appears there is that that is one of the more common ways, an incentive. You know, it might be $5 or something like that, but something that would incent a behavior. We put a limit of $25,000 on it. It's a relatively low amount. That's not to say we are obligated to spend $25,000 in a given year. So that's, that's the best I guess I can lay it out. There's no malice or anything else here. We're not trying to put one over, but we want to be consistent with other agencies. And right now, to be able to do anything, we have to have statutory authority. We can't just do it on our own.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Torres Ray.
I just think that this is very poorly worded, if that's your intention.
That's just
just to say that, you know, you won $25,000 for incentives and gift cards obviously brings these concerns, very legitimate concerns from the senator. I'm concerned too. I think that what you're trying to say is that you need to develop a program to make sure that we get feedback from those students that receive these loans. And you should develop that, and you should let us know. So I would like to suggest that you actually put some language in here that actually reflects that. I think absolutely you need to get information from these students and these families that receive all of these resources from the federal government and from us. And you need to find ways to make sure that they participate. That's not what Subdivision 3 says. So I would like to encourage you to tell us, you know, because really I have a problem with the language myself, saying, you know, you need $25,000 for gift cards.
Mr. Chair,
that's appropriate.
You know, we really had the intention that only non-controversial things would be in here and that anything that needed more discussion would get moved to the policy bill. So I move that we delete lines 2.28 to lines 2.31.
2.26?
Yeah, thank you.
2.26 to 2.31?
2.31, yes.
Any discussion? Seeing none, Senator Bonoff has moved that we restrict lines 2.26 to 2.31 in Senate File 1535. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same signal. Passed. Senator Bonham.
Ms. Hendricks.
Mr. Chair, we'll just move very quickly through Article 1. Section 4 relates to the Student Advisory Council and simply clarifies that rather than you don't want to go through that level of detail. Okay, are there any other questions on Article 1? Okay.
Seeing none. Ms. Henderson, go ahead.
So Article 2, the remaining statute, would remove a reference to the Achieve Scholarship Program, as that program has not been funded since fiscal year 2011. Both Sections 2 and Section 3 relate to the Achieve Scholarship Program.
Mr. Chair, can I back up a moment? So sorry.
Yes. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on page 3, which has to do with collecting fees. And I'm curious why we are no longer collecting them annually. And are these the fees that private institutions pay for licensure? And does this mean they would not be paid annually? If so, I'd like to hear from them.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, my understanding is that we're just removing the word annually because it's redundant. Appropriation implies that it's an annual amount.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ms. Henderson, as you continue, could you reference the page numbers as you're going through as well?
Sure. My apologies. So to clarify my comments on Article 2, were page 29.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions related to Article 2, we will skip to Article 3 and pages 37 through 39. Sections 17 and 18 are in response to a number of complaints we have received from students. The complaint relates to instances where students have taken out institutional loans, and as such, if they are delinquent or have defaulted on their loans, the institution has withheld their transcript. This has left students in a really difficult situation as they cannot transfer to another institution or get a job. And this also aligns with rules surrounding federal loans and other loan programs. And so it's a simple clarification that should a student be delinquent or default on an institutional loan, the institution cannot withhold their transcript as a penalty.
Very good. Thank you.
And then the final remaining section is Section 19, which is also on page 39, and just instructs the reviser to make any necessary cross-references. Any further questions?
Yes, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you talk about the repealers a little bit and what's being repealed?
Ms. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, from my understanding, those the repealers have been taken out given the A2 amendment.
Oh, sorry. I didn't catch up.
Mr. Fuller, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bonner.
Mr. Fuller, we took out most repealers, but can you address Senator Pratt's question?
Mr. Fuller.
Testify is right. The repealers on page 39 were deleted. Okay. I'll just have to go through the paper and the other ones.
Thank you. I missed it on the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
While Mr. Fuller is going through that, Senator Nelson, you had a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just a quick question. On page 29, we're striking out the, on 29.25, we're striking out the Achieve Scholarship Program. And but I also notice it's not in capital letters like Minnesota Promises. So what exactly is no longer eligible for funding if we strike out the Achieve Scholarship Program?
Ms. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, my understanding is that it was a proper name of a program that was funded through the fiscal year of 2010. It was not refunded in 2011, but it has remained in statute. There are bills introduced that may mirror what was done in the Achieve Scholarship Program, but they do not have that name, and they wouldn't be captured in this language.
Thank you.
We're going to come back to Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, so on page 29, at the bottom of the page, the repealer, that is the Achieve program. And on page 28, the repealer, the 135A.25, that was deleted, so that's not repealed. And the 158 provisions have to do with the University Hospital, which doesn't have any more. And so it's archaic and obsolete. Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions? Senator Boniff moves Senate File 1535 as amended, and it's recommended to pass and move to the floor of the Senate. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. 1535 passes. And Senator Boniff, we have now 1194.
Mr. Chair, we do, and this is the state grant changes, and the state grant bill has been sent to the policy committee first for us to look at the policy changes, not to approve the dollar amounts.
Very good. And we are having a, there is a handout being distributed, so we'll wait till all people have that. This is a chart that looks at state grant spending by family income. Senator Boniff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the what you have before you are recommended changes to the state grant program. As we know, we've got significant debt. We rank fifth in the United States for the highest average debt. While we are seeing lower delinquency rates in other kinds of debt, we are not seeing lower delinquency rates on student debt. And so we have a real wonderful, award-winning program in Minnesota in our state grant program. I've been to national conferences where we are singled out for our state grant program because it uses it's strictly need, and it allows for our Minnesota students to have choice. And so we say that, you know, a student, if you're qualified for Pell, and then we even go above that, that you'd also qualify for state aid. And so they can take that, as you know, anywhere in our state. And so all of the systems love the state grant program. And so what this bill before you does, that helps to solve what we consider sort of the family donut hole, that after the recession, those in kind of the bottom of the middle class that didn't qualify for Pell, but yet their families were struggling and they didn't seem to have enough money to help them, those are the kids in some ways that got hurt worse throughout the recession. And so our proposal expands availability for that subset. And I'm, you know, really here with an expert in the whole state grant program. And so Ms. Ferris will take us through the actual changes, proposed changes of the bill, not because she supports the changes, because she's only allowed to support governor's proposed changes, but here as a technical support and expert. And we are so blessed to be here with the new president of St. Ben's. And thank you for coming, and thank you for sitting through this entire hearing and waiting until we get to you. So.
Well, welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Meredith Fergus. I'm the State Grant Analyst for the Office of Higher Education, here to kind of walk you through the technical changes. The first technical change in the bill for lines from essentially subdivision or section one changes the proration amounts or the modifiers for the assigned family responsibility. And essentially what that is, members, just a reminder, is when you submit a FAFSA, the U.S. Department of Education calculates the amount that you should contribute based on your family income and assets. If that amount is $1,000 for parents or for a student and or their spouse if they have one, we bring that amount into the state grant award calculation, but we modify it because we've believed over in the history that for most families it is too high. Under current law, the modifier for dependent students is a 0.96. This would change that modifier to a 0.79. So for a family that was assessed a $1,000 contribution, it would now drop to $790 in the state grant award calculation. There are similar changes for independent students, both with children and without children. Those with children, the modifier would drop from 0.86 to 7.7. For those with children or without children, it would drop from 0.5 to 0.34. Those modifiers do differ based on the extent that within that federal process, there are a number of breaks given to families with children. So that is section one. Section two modifies the tuition fee maximums for the state grant program. Line 1.18 increases the tuition maximum for students in four-year programs from the current $13,000 to $13,620, which approximates tuition and fees at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Line 1.19 actually does not change the tuition and fee maximum for students in two-year programs. That level is slightly above the highest public two-year tuition right now. On line 2.1 to 2.3, we are modifying the living and miscellaneous expense allowance for the state grant program. The current level in law is $7,900. The Office of Higher Education temporarily increased that amount this year to $8,490 based on available appropriations. That increase, though, was temporary. To make that a permanent increase, you will need to change it in law. The author has proposed changing those levels to $8,858 for fiscal year 16 and $8,958 for fiscal year 17, which approximates the federal poverty level for a single person for 9 months.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just some summary data. With these changes, MinSCU, the two-year program, would see 9,400 new recipients. The MinSCU 4 years would see 1,800 new recipients. UMN would see 1,400 new recipients. The not-for-profit privates would see 1,700, and the for-profits would see 1,600.
Thank you.
600, what did I say?
Doctor.
600, excuse me.
Should we call upon Dr. Hinton?
Yep, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mary Hinton, and I am the president of the College of St. Benedict, located in St. Joseph, Minnesota. I am honored to be before you today to testify about the importance and the value of the state grants program to the College of St. Benedict and the students we serve. In the fall of this academic year, I received an email from a student expressing gratitude for the financial support she received from St. Ben's. This young woman from the Twin Cities was essentially homeless her senior year in high school. With great academic ability, she applied to and was admitted to more than a dozen colleges and universities, yet she did not think she would be able to attend any of those schools due to her financial circumstance. None of the financial aid awards she received enabled her to attend college without incurring a grievous amount of debt. I'm proud that St. Ben's was able to provide her with enough financial support, and she is currently attending and excelling at CSB. I share this story with you because it illustrates one critically important component of the state grant. St. Ben's would not have been able to provide all of the financial assistance this young woman needed without her state grant aid. Though we will provide approximately $40 million in institutional financial aid to our undergraduate students, and I should clarify that that $40 million is institutional aid, not reflecting any external grants or loans, we still very much need and are grateful for the state grant. This year, Minnesota State Grants will provide a particularly important source of assistance for 570 St. Ben's students. That's 29% of the students we serve. Collectively, they will receive $2.5 million in state grant aid. That's the second largest form of grant aid for our students after our institutional grants and scholarships. The state grant enables us to make a private college education possible for young people who may not believe it is an option for them. This is a key part of our mission and the mission of many Minnesota private colleges, and we take it quite seriously. At St. Ben's, nearly 24% of all new entering students in fall 2014 are first-generation college students. Nearly 3 in 10 of those students report family incomes below $40,000 a year. We retain first-generation students at very high rates. Since 2010, we have retained an average of 86% of first-generation and Pell Grant students from the first to second year, comparable to our 88% retention rate for all other students. As we look at the increasing racial and ethnic diversity in Minnesota, it is also essential that we educate students of color. American students of color make up 18% of all St. Ben's students in fall 2014. They likely will comprise nearly 20% of all new students in fall 2015. The total number of first-year to senior American students of color at St. Ben's has nearly quadrupled since 2003. This is a trend that we are excited about and are eager to embrace. This year, our applicant pool consisted of 30% American students of color. Our acceptance rate is 74% for students of color, and that compares to 88% among white students. We are able to identify and generate significant interest among American students of color who want to attend St. Ben's. The state grant is essential for this emerging and critically important population. The median family income for new students of color at St. Ben's in fall 2014 was approximately $49,000, compared to $109,000, the median income for new white students. Since the goal of the state grant is to expand access, then I'm happy to testify that it is accomplishing its goal at the College of St. Benedict. However, I believe that the state grant does do more. By enabling low-income and students of color access to private education, the state grant is facilitating student success. At CSB, we retain 82% of all new entering students of color from the entering class in 2013. Our first to second year retention rates of students of color consistently exceeds 80%. It's also important to note that our students complete college in 4 years. Among students who first enroll in the fall of 2010, 76% of our American students of color completed college in 4 years. Nationally, fewer than 3 in 10 students of color earn their baccalaureate degrees in 4 years. We have been able to break through one of the most entrenched disparities in higher education, and this success is not just limited to the College of St. Benedict. While I am most intimately familiar with our data, I can tell you that Minnesota private colleges graduate the highest percentage of students overall by both 4 and 6 year measures, and Minnesota private colleges graduate the highest percentage of students of color in 4 years. We are able to do this because of the state grant. Need-based aid helps students succeed because it enables us to recruit, enroll, and retain students. It's essential to giving a full range of educational choices, enabling students to choose the college that will best serve them. It's essential to closing the achievement gaps. It helps reduce income and race-based disparities in educational outcomes. For all of these reasons, investing additional funding in the state grant program is a sound and effective way to ensure long-term stability and growth for Minnesota. I am happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for allowing me to share my testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Hinton. That was a very encouraging report on private colleges in Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm honored to present it.
Yes. Any questions from committee members?
We do have a student from Hamlin, Sarah Blesey.
Welcome, Sarah, to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Blesey, and I'm a sophomore at Hamlin University in St. Paul. I am a double major in biology and chemistry with a forensic science certificate. I want to thank you for investing in students through the Minnesota State Grant Program and want to tell you why the program is so important to me. I am from Alexandria, Minnesota, and I'm a first-generation student. There are seven kids in my family, and me and my twin brother are the youngest of those. I am the first of my siblings to attend a four-year university, and neither of my parents attended one either. I knew I wanted to go to Hamlin University. Before I ever stepped foot on the campus, I was attracted to its strong science programs and its chemistry background. I wanted the personal attention that the professors truly give you at Hamlin. I love it there, and I've never, ever questioned the fact that it was the right place for me to go. Hamlin has been able to give me some absolutely amazing opportunities. I just found out that I was accepted for a full-time undergraduate research position at the University of Notre Dame for this summer. I will be going there to do collaborative research with them and with the assistance of one of my professors to study analytical techniques for detecting drugs in developing countries. At Hamlin, I work three jobs. I am yearbook editor, and I have a staff that works for me there. I also work in the Involvement Center in our Student Activities Center, and I am a teaching assistant in the Chemistry Department and assist in lab preparation. Between these three jobs, I probably work at least 30 hours a week. And over the summer, I had to work two full-time jobs in retail and fast food, averaging about 75 to 80 hours a week. During that time frame, I did live out of my car part-time as more of a convenience factor to maximize how much sleep I was able to get between jobs, because usually it was only about 4 to 5 hours between jobs. I am very grateful to receive the state grant. I also have a lot of scholarships that I've been able to earn through my university, whether that be science or in leadership, and still have had to take out loans to attend this school. But the Minnesota State Grant definitely makes it more of a possibility for me to attend Hamlin, and thank you for your investment into the program.
Thank you, and best wishes in your new upcoming position.
Thank you.
That's great. Can I ask, you said you have six siblings?
Yes, I do. Between my step-siblings and my biological siblings, okay. There are seven of us.
Has your goal and drive to get that college degree rubbed off on any of them?
Mm-hmm. No, but they are very supportive of what I do. when I got accepted for the research program, that was definitely a text that got sent out, and definitely support from my family is very powerful and driving me.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Senator Boniff, any other testifiers?
No.
Okay.
There's somebody else would like to testify.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Yes. No. We did have a person.
That's right. From the university, Ms. Strangle.
Sequel.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bonhoff, thank you for having me here today, and thank you for bringing this forward. I'll keep my statement brief, as I believe that Senator Bonhoff has done a wonderful job of talking about the need for this bill. But once again, I'm the student body president at the University of Minnesota, and I also work on the coalition that represents the full system. And we're very supportive of the bill because of the benefit it provides to the group of students that are increasingly squeezed out of higher education. These are the students that on paper appear to have families that can afford an education, and I am one of those students. They're the students that the FAFSA and other formulas don't work for because it forgets that snapshot of your earnings does not paint the bigger picture of the family's lifetime earnings. These are the parents that are educators, nurses, small business owners, owners, middle-class families that have been crippled by the recession, delved into savings to make ends meet, or went without work, and they limited their ability of what they could invest for their students. And again, I'm a product of that. I'm a product of parents who had to dip into the savings that they had originally put away for me to go to college, as they have modest salaries as educators, but then were unable to fund any part of my education during the recession. There are also the students of parents with large debt loads, like my family. My dad shoulders over $150,000 in student loan debt, a decision he carefully calculated, knowing that that short-term raise you can get by going back to school would then be debt that he had to incur later. But it was a decision that we had to make at that moment in time in order to be able to make ends meet, again, as an educator. And that's debt that's not included in the federal or state formulas when calculating aid. So although my family has $150,000 in debt, when I fill out the FAFSA, the very same document that gave my father his debt that he has, they don't take that into account in terms of evaluating my aid. And I think that that's a really powerful statement, and I think that the expansion of the state grant program helps alleviate some of that and fill that gap in there. So generally, we support the bill because it seeks to fill that gap that broken formulas in the recession have created by expanding the number of middle-class students eligible for the grant. We believe that this is a common-sense solution to curb the rising debt loads and provide for families where the expected contribution doesn't match the reality of what their contribution is and causes them, in turn, to incur the large debt loads in order to attain a college degree. So once again, thank Senator Bana for bringing this forward. I think it's very important that this conversation is happening, and I thank all the members here for hearing this important bill.
Thank you, Ms. Stangler.
Mr. Chair, yes. I just get so moved when I listen to our students and their stories and when I listen to Dr. Hinton, and I think I always am left with, we've got to do more, for heaven's sakes. But thank you for hearing this today.
Do we have any additional testifiers or people in the audience that would like to come forward? Okay. Seeing none, Senator Bonoff would like to move, recommend to pass Senate File 1194 and to re-refer to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Senate File 1194 passes and will be referred to Finance. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. With that, seeing no other business, we are adjourned.